This is Law Bites, a podcast with Michael Geist.
As Canadians' lives and communication increasingly move online, the Supreme Court issued one of its strongest rulings on internet privacy yet. Police will need warrants to get IP addresses, a unique number assigned to every device on a network. Even though an IP address doesn't directly identify people, the court found it is a crucial link between an internet user and their online activity, as well as the first digital breadcrumb that can lead the state on a trail of an individual's internet activity.
The federal government has struggled to update Canadian privacy laws over the past decade, leaving the Supreme Court as perhaps the leading source of privacy protection. In 2014, the court issued the Spencer decision, which affirmed a reasonable expectation of privacy in basic subscriber information, and earlier this month, it released the Bykovitz ruling, which extends the reasonable expectation of privacy principle to IP addresses. Vibert Jack is the litigation director of the BC Civil Liberties Association, which successfully intervened in the case. He joins me on the podcast to examine the decision, including the evolution of Canadian law, the court's analysis, and the implications of Bykovitz for internet privacy in Canada. Vibert, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you for having me. Really appreciate the opportunity.
Yeah, no, I'm really glad that you've come on, and congratulations on a successful intervention in what is a really important internet privacy case. And I'm glad you're taking the time to come on to explore the decision as well as some of the background leading up to it. And then we can talk a little bit, I hope, as well about what the implications are and where this leads. Before we do that, the decision that we're talking about is Bykovitz. Can you talk a little bit about what sparked this case and what its path was to the Supreme Court of Canada?
Right. So the case involved an investigation, an online investigation into fraudulent purchases of gift cards. I think it was a stolen credit card that the person was using. So the Calgary Police Service, as part of their investigation, requested IP addresses that were used for the purchases from Moneris, which is a third-party payment processing company. Moneris voluntarily provided two IP addresses to the police, which the police then used to get a production order to get subscriber information from the internet service provider, the ISP, which they received, and then that eventually led to the arrest of the accused. And before the trial, the accused brought an application arguing that the police request to Moneris for his IP address violated his right against unreasonable search and seizure under Section 8 of the Charter. The trial judge found that the accused had no expectation of privacy in his IP address, so Section 8 wasn't engaged at all. That's the threshold to even be able to make arguments about your privacy interest. On appeal, the majority of the Court of Appeal agreed with the trial judge that there was no expectation of privacy. There was one dissent at the Court of Appeal. So that meant that there was an appeal to the Supreme Court of Canada as of right, but only on that one issue. And then finally, at the Supreme Court of Canada, the court reversed those lower decisions and expanded Section 8 protections to cover IP addresses.
Okay, that's a really helpful background, with the core focus ultimately at the Supreme Court on reasonable expectation of privacy with respect to IP addresses. Now, longtime privacy watchers will recall certainly the very lengthy battles over lawful access, and then later the Spencer decision invoking similar but not identical issues with respect to subscriber information and access to that kind of information without a warrant. Can you provide a bit of a background in how the courts and some of the policymakers have addressed these issues? It's really been one that's now in many ways been ongoing for at least the last couple of decades in terms of this sort of ping-ponging between law enforcement seeking access to this information. Sometimes it's being disclosed without a warrant. Sometimes people saying come back with a warrant, and the court's being asked to adjudicate where there is a reasonable expectation of privacy.
Yeah, so lawful access is a broad term, kind of covers law enforcement seeking access to any kind of information online. But for Spencer, the specific issue, as you mentioned, was warrantless access to subscriber information. So Spencer was a case in 2014 that the Supreme Court of Canada held that police do need judicial authorization before they request subscriber information from ISPs. So meaning the police have your IP address, they go to your ISP and they ask for usually your name and address. Prior to Spencer, the general practice was that ISPs would just share that information voluntarily. Police would just send them a letter asking for it, and usually they would provide it. And there was a belief amongst ISPs and law enforcement generally that this was lawful based on exceptions in privacy legislation. In Spencer, that was PIPEDA, exemptions that allowed information to be shared for the purpose of law enforcement investigations. And again, before Spencer, courts had generally allowed this behavior, although they often allowed it based on kind of different reasoning from one decision to the next. So there were a number of cases on this issue, and eventually it made its way to the Supreme Court of Canada in Spencer, where the court made two important holdings. One was to recognize that privacy rights included an interest to remain anonymous online. And so information that would tend to reveal one's online activity would be protected under Section 8. And also, the court rejected the idea that the police common law power to investigate crimes was enough to trigger the exemption in the privacy law. And so there needed to be some specific legal authority for the police to obtain that information. Following Spencer, policymakers have suggested introducing laws to kind of roll back those protections. So, for example, in 2016, there was a national security green paper that suggested creating laws to allow warrantless access to basic subscriber information. What was that issue in Spencer? Amongst other similar rollbacks, but that's what's relevant to this to that case. And also, more recently, we saw similar provisions included in early versions of the Online Arms Bill, which is currently before the House of Commons, although they've been removed. So, thankfully, we say, at least at the BCCLA, that these changes haven't been successful. But certainly, we can see that Spencer wasn't the end of the debate, and I'm doubtful that Bykovets will be the end of the discussion either.
Yeah, no, I think that's right. And we'll come back to so where that debate will head in just a little bit. And I'm glad you brought back the fact that there were lawful access provisions included in some of the government's early thinking around online harms, which is, of course, generating a lot of discussion and debate, and yet was ultimately didn't make its way into the legislation. Perhaps it finds its way into a separate bill or not at all. We'll have to see. In any event, back to Bykovits. The Supreme Court of Canada's process was a little bit unusual. Case was first argued in January 2023, and there was a rehearing in December of the same year, December of 2023, so several months ago before leading up to this decision. What appears to have taken place from a process perspective?
Yeah, I would say it was quite unusual even. And before I answer your question, I'll just put a caveat that the court didn't make any public announcements about any of this. So there's nothing official, no official explanation, but I'm pretty sure that this process was the result of Justice Brown's departure from the court in June of 2023, so about midway between the hearing and the ultimate decision being released. Initially, the case was heard by a panel of seven justices, including Justice Brown. And so once he stepped down, it would appear that the remaining six justices ended up in a tie. And assuming that nobody kind of changed between that point and when the final decision came out, you would have had Chief Justice Wagner and Justices Cote and O'Bonswin on one side, with Justices Kerkitsanis, Martin, and Jamal on the other. That would have resulted in, you know, a tie at the Supreme Court results in the decision at the Court of Appeal being upheld. So in this case, that would have meant that, Mr. Bykovic's conviction would have been upheld. And I think because, you know, his liberty was at stake, the court did not want to have that be the result, him, you know, going to prison on based on a tie. So they'd actually released a decision which said that the case would be reheard, and indicated that they may ask for some further submissions from the parties and interveners, which didn't happen. So then a full panel of nine judges was reheard the case, I guess, based on the written submissions and oral submissions that had already been made. Essentially you had Justice Roe signing on to the reasons of Justice Cote, which ended up being the minority, and then Justices Morrow and Kassir signing on to Justice Kerkitsanis's reasons, which ended up being the majority decision. And I think that's all pretty safe to say. The next thing I'm going to say is more of really a guess, but based on Justice Brown's questions during the hearing, I would guess that had he stuck around and been part of the decision, it probably would have gone the other way, actually.
Well, that's, it's amazing to think of just that this really landmark decision when it comes to internet privacy swings on that narrow an edge in terms of the prospect of flipping one way or the other, just based on one judge going and three new judges coming in and the way that it shifted. It's quite remarkable when you think about sort of that, a little bit the happenstance about how some of that plays out. Now, you mentioned some of his questions at the hearing. Obviously, you appeared as an intervener in the case. What issues were you trying to bring to the court's attention? And beyond, I guess, Justice Brown's responses, what kind of engagement did you sense from the court during the hearing?
So we focused on the normative approach to privacy rights, and specifically tried to provide some points in favor of why the court should recognize a reasonable expectation of privacy. Broadly, we made three points. One was that we talked about the power imbalances between online corporations and consumers, and this concept of the privacy paradox, where there's a discrepancy between consumers' stated desire for strong privacy protections versus their actual choices that do not appear to prioritize privacy. And we pointed out to the court that individuals today really have no choice but to go online. That's the only way to participate in modern society. And that necessarily means disclosing their IP addresses, which means, from our point of view, it's not really a voluntary disclosure. And especially considering that the disclosure of your IP addresses and lots of other information that corporations collect about you is governed by contracts of adhesion that users really have no ability to alter or negotiate, and also that data is often collected without our knowledge. And kind of building from there, the next point that we made was to point out the risks associated with allowing corporate interests to augment state power. So there's a distinction, we say, between disclosing information for non-law enforcement purposes versus disclosing it to the state, and allowing corporations to share information based on a simple request from law enforcement essentially means unreasonably expanding police powers. It's a big problem because corporate interests are not necessarily or even at all aligned with civil liberties. We can point to an example that just happened here in Vancouver, where there was a shooting in a parking lot and the police went to the restaurant and asked to be given a copy of their security footage. And the restaurant asked the police to get a warrant. And there was just a huge outcry in the media. We had provincial ministers castigating the restaurant for not voluntarily participating with the police investigation. So, you know, there's a big blowback for the business. And so you can see that their interests really isn't to protect the privacy of their customers necessarily. In a parking lot with a video camera, that's one thing, but online with new technologies emerging that allow corporations to collect just vast troves of information about us. And not only collect information, but then exchange and collate and synthesize that information to reveal new insights about us. And we know that many corporations are creating extremely detailed profiles about their users, allowing that type of information to be accessed by the state without any judicial oversight. It's a very scary process. And Professor Lisa Austin at U of T describes these corporate entities as potential technological tattletales that can cooperate with the police, again, based on their own interests and thereby augment state power. And then the final point that we made was just that other jurisdictions, especially the EU, we pointed to, have recognized these issues and expanded privacy protections to IP addresses for nearly a decade. So I think there was good engagement on those points at the hearing, and certainly looking at the decision, the majority decision, they really took up a lot of these issues. They referenced our arguments specifically as well, which is pretty rare for interveners. So we were very happy with how we feel like we had an impact on the decision.
Yeah, no, and you should be. I mean, I think you put forward really compelling arguments when it comes to online privacy in particular, and it is good to see the court pick up on it. Why don't we turn then to the decision and the court, as we talked about previously, of having looked at basic subscriber information, now looking specifically at IP addresses. Can you talk a bit about what the majority of the court in particular concludes and how it appears to be thinking about privacy, particularly in the internet space?
Only issue in the final holding was that the court did recognize a reasonable expectation of privacy in IP addresses, and in doing that, they rejected the Crown's argument that IP addresses are just a set of numbers that are useless without the subscriber information, and that because of that, a Spencer warrant is sufficient, kind of in all cases. So the court rejected that argument, and made 3 points, kind of boiling things down quite a bit, but essentially that IP addresses as the link that connects specific internet activity to a specific location can betray deeply personal information just on their own. Second, that activity associated with the IP address can be correlated with other online activity associated with that same IP address. That might be readily available to the state. And then finally, that an IP address can set the state on a trail of internet activity that leads directly to a user's identity, even without a Spencer warrant. So I think it's, to me, it's obvious anyway. If you go look at someone's Facebook page or LinkedIn page, there's a lot of information there that's very personal. And if you can just ask the company for the IP address, then you've already, it's a one-step process to connect very personal information to one's IP address. More broadly, I think there's a lot of language in the decision that will apply in many other contexts. And there's two kind of themes that the majority talked about in that sense. So one was the, or is the difference between the online and offline world. So they quoted, I think Justice Kara Katsenis quoted herself from the Ramelson decision in 2022, saying online spaces are qualitatively different from physical spaces, and talked about how informational privacy is a particularly challenging issue, and that the court's jurisprudence recognizes that computers are unique and present privacy risks that differ from Section 8's traditional objects. So it's kind of this idea that really the Section 8 analysis is distinct and different when we're talking about online searches. And then the second issue was that they picked up on this idea of the risk posed by third-party actors to our privacy rights, and talked about how the internet has allowed mass concentration of information into the hands of corporations, and has in effect added a third party to the constitutional ecosystem, making the horizontal relationship between the individual and the state now tripartite, which I think is a pretty huge shift or idea for the court to pick up. Obviously, corporations are not governed by the charter, not subject to the charter, but it's a very important step forward, I think, to recognize how corporations are becoming more and more intertwined with the state, like we talked about in our intervention, how they can augment state power. And so it was very nice to see the majority talking about that concept.
Yeah, no, it's interesting to see them embrace those arguments as a majority. Now, you mentioned that at one stage, it appears that the court was truly divided, and then obviously still comes down to a 5-4 decision. Does the dissent simply come down to a different view of whether or not there ought to be a reasonable expectation of privacy in IP addresses? Is there something more at play, differences in terms of their view of privacy online more broadly?
So in kind of technical legal terms, I think the difference can be summed up in the approach to the application of the normative standard to the reasonable expectation of privacy, which I mentioned a bit earlier, but it's the idea that Section 8 should protect privacy interests that not only where there's an actual expectation of privacy, but where we as a society should recognize an expectation of privacy. And so that means that you have to look, well, the majority said it means you have to look beyond the facts of the case. You have to look at what are the implications if we don't recognize an expectation of privacy, or what are the broader implications? And so that's what the majority did. They asked the question, kind of, what information do IP addresses tend to reveal, rather than what they may be revealed in this particular case? The minority went the opposite route, took a more narrow view and really focused only on the facts of this case, and said in this scenario where you've got this stepwise investigation, you collect the IP address, then you go get a Spencer warrant, nothing is happening in between, so there's no reasonable expectation of privacy there. So that's what led to the different outcomes. I think I would say, you know, why they take those different views, that there's some underlying differences in how the different justices view privacy rights, and probably kind of view their role as a court as well. I think you could describe it as kind of a conservative versus liberal view, and small L, small C, I mean. You know, the law is conservative by nature. The common law evolves slowly and by design. But I think in this case, the majority recognized the need for the law to stay ahead of technological advances. And so, you know, if you're waiting to see a problem arise with technology before you correct it, you're already going to be behind the eight ball because there's some new technological advance around the corner. So it's just not going to work in the long run, I think. So I would agree with the majority's approach in this case for sure. Looking back at Rommelson, a case that I mentioned earlier, there's a lot of similar language in that case, kind of on the high level about the difference between online and offline spaces and the need to protect privacy online. The case was quoted extensively by the majority here, and that case, Rommelson, was a unanimous decision. So I do think there's also substantial agreement throughout the court, at least on a theoretical level, although in practice it might play out differently from case to case.
Yeah, no, it's interesting to see those potential differences. Now the immediate reaction, at least from law enforcement, which kind of mirrored the response that came from law enforcement after Spencer and throughout much of the debate on lawful access when those reforms really seemed to get bogged down and struggle, was that they argued the decision would harm police investigations. You know, that's kind of the standard response to this. You're just making it too hard for us to do our jobs. What are your thoughts on those claims? And do you have a sense that there's much evidence that the kind of warnings that they provided or made years ago after Spencer have actually come to to fruition? Is that something that they've been able to muster to suggest, here's the proof that this actually does create real issues on our end?
Yeah, so it's really surprising that the police would say that a police power can't be taken away. It's going to ruin everything. Sky is falling, all those things. I mean, it's, you know, it's, as you said, it's the usual reaction. And so it's hard to put much stake in it, frankly. I'm not aware of empirical evidence that kind of makes out those claims post Spencer. These arguments were brought up in Bykovitz. It was discussed during the hearing. It's addressed in the decision. And I didn't see any evidence being mustered in this case, which I think probably would have been if it was there. So, of course, there's going to be an impact on investigations. But that's kind of the point. That's kind of the point of Section 8. It makes you slow down, makes you double check things, requires some oversight. That's necessary to protect our privacy interests. And I can kind of see maybe the complaints following Spencer. You're going from no judicial oversight to some judicial oversight. So there's probably going to be, you know, a bigger difference there. But going from Spencer to Bykovitz, I don't see the predictions of this causing any serious issues. On the one hand, the Crown wanted to argue that there's no private information that can be gleaned from an IP address, and that it's, again, just useless information without the information that you get from a Spencer warrant. And then at the same time, they want to argue that this is so disruptive to investigations. But I don't really get it. I mean, you need a warrant anyway. So it's just changing when you get it. And the court, you know, talked about some of the practical realities of how that should all shake out, and found that it really shouldn't be an undue burden.
Now, acknowledging that that your sense is that there has not been much evidence, or at least there hasn't been evidence mustered about some of the challenges that this may or may not have created sort of post Spencer, and that would be that my take as well. Indeed, throughout much of the lawful access debate that I found myself engaged in going back a long time, one of the sources of frustration was that there was just oftentimes virtually no evidence being brought forward. And even in one instance that I can recall debating with, I think it was the public safety minister at the time, Peter Van Loan, and he provided a single incident that he said he'd experienced. And I remember filing an access request with the law enforcement to learn about it. And it turned out it wasn't quite exactly as he had described. So it never seemed that there was all that much evidence around it. But that said, there was a push post Spencer to create a new kind of warrant, so that a Spencer warrant would be a specific kind of warrant, perhaps with a lower threshold. Do you have thoughts about whether or not we are likely to see the same thing now, and in a sense, almost rejuvenating that argument to say that this now covers even a broader range, potentially of internet-related information, and law enforcement saying that, making the same argument, evidence-free or otherwise, that they require some sort of mechanism to be able to obtain this information and that the existing warrant process is too onerous?
Well, I think we can definitely say that they're going to make those arguments for sure. Whether it happens or not, it's a bit harder to say. Again, the majority in this case did address these exact concerns about the practical difficulties for law enforcement that would arise. And they pointed to a specific section of the criminal code that allows for production orders for information relating to a specified transmission of a communication, and that's on just the standard of a reasonable suspicion. So the majority said that would have been available in this case and should not be difficult to get. And they also talked about how law enforcement should be able to get this, if you want to call it a Bykovitz warrant or whatever you want to call it, but you know, this warrant for an IP address at the same time as a warrant for the subscriber information that we know that they would need anyway. So you're not really adding steps. Maybe it's a bit more of an onerous process to get that production order. I don't know, but again, I don't think you're adding a lot of, you're not adding a new step to the process anyway. But having said all of that, you know, the goal is not just to have privacy for privacy's sake. The goal is to have a balance between privacy interests and law enforcement interests. So to the extent that it can be shown that that's not happening, we wouldn't be opposed in principle to some amendments to the criminal code or otherwise that would address that problem, if it's a real problem, as long as those amendments provide adequate protection for privacy interests. As you've mentioned, it's been many years where governments have been trying to do that and have been failing. So I don't know if that part of it, the practical aspect of changing the laws, will change.
Yeah, no, I think you're right. And that challenge of ensuring that privacy rights really do mean something, but also ensure striking some kind of balance and recognizing that there is a law enforcement has some sort of job to do has proven to be a really challenging issue, to be sure. But it's through work like yours, through BCCLA and others that were involved in this case that certainly have helped crystallize where the court stands on it. And I think stands as a really important decision with respect to the privacy rights of all Canadians online. So thank you for your work in that area, and thank you so much for joining me on the podcast today.
Thank you for having me. Like I said, it's a real pleasure for me, an honor. And I'd say also want to mention your work in advancing these interests as well is incredibly important. So thank you.
That's the Law Bites podcast for this week. If you have comments, suggestions, or other feedback, write to lawbites@pobox.com. Follow the podcast on Twitter @LawBitesPod or Michael Geist @MGeist. You can download the latest episodes from my website at michaelgeist.ca or subscribe via RSS at Apple Podcast, Google, or Spotify. The Law Bites podcast is produced by Gerardo LeBron LeBoy. Music by the LeBoy brothers, Gerardo and Jose LeBron LeBoy. Credit information for the clips featured in this podcast can be found in the show notes for this episode at michaelgeist.ca. I'm Michael Geist. Thanks for listening, and see you next time.